Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Hard to believe it will be 50 years ago in August since Martin Luther King Jr. gave his now iconic I Have a Dream speech. But Dr. King gave an earlier version of that speech on June 23, 1963 in Detroit. On today's show, we take a look back to the events during that address that some Detroiters believe was just as important as the March on Washington. Then, as the first day of summer rears its head tomorrow, Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon joins us to remember summer's past. But first, it's Thursday, time for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, as the story of Detroit's possible and many say likely bankruptcy continues to unfold, we keep hearing that many parties are going to feel pain, feel financial hardship. So I'm thinking when you're looking at all the possible parties who will be feeling pain, it seems some of the most vulnerable have to be city retirees.
Unfortunately, I think that's probably true. The banks and the bondholders and bond insurers, are clearly going to take a financial hit. But they don't probably pay their bills and their mortgage and their heat and light bill with those funds, whereas retirees from the city of Detroit, current and future, do. And a lot of people, particularly those who've already retired, built their lives around the expectation of what their pension payouts were going to be. Now it becomes increasingly clear the more we get into this that those are at risk. Emergency manager Kevin Orr has said that he will try to take a chunk out of the pensions. He also has dismissed verbally the fact that the constitutional protection in the Michigan Constitution of vested pension benefits really is not the ironclad protection that people have assumed it has been since 1963 when the Constitution was revised.
Wow.
And the more you dig into this and you find additional kinds of writing on the subject, I think increasingly a lot of the lawyers and the legal people think that's the case as well. What it says in the Constitution is that these are contractual obligations. And they cannot be diminished. Well, once you get into bankruptcy, part of bankruptcy gives the debtor, which in this case would be the city, the opportunity or the chance to break, revise, reject contracts.
Right, because that's the whole premise of the whole process.
Exactly,
it's
right.
Built on that.
And so yesterday I had the opportunity to talk to Attorney General Bill Schuette, and as you might imagine, he was very guarded about what he would say about this thing because he may be asked to render some kind of opinion down the road on this. Hmm. But he did say that federal bankruptcy judge would make a decision on this. And I think clearly that this is something that would be kicked into bankruptcy court and would be a fundamental issue in this whole proceeding.
And it would be advantageous if you are a leader, appointed or otherwise, if you're a civic or state leader, to let the bankruptcy judge be the fall guy, be the bad guy.
Politically, it might be. I'm not sure that it would be advantageous to your members and your pensioners.
Correct.
I think that's really the question. So, I mean, we've seen this in Detroit politics and, frankly, in the national political scene for a very long time, that decisions made by leaders are often for the benefit, the political benefit of the leadership, not necessarily the members. And I think what Kevin Orr is trying to signal is you can probably get a little better deal from me outside of bankruptcy than you're likely to get inside bankruptcy. Now, I suspect that there's a lot of people that don't believe. They think either deal is just going to be awful. So why not go into bankruptcy, blame it on the judge, and that gives people more of a fig leaf to stand behind. You know, look, if the state constitution does say what it does say, and it does say that the accrued financial benefits of each pension plan shall be a contractual obligation, and people have grown up thinking that, there is no way, it seems to me, that these pension funds and these unions cannot go into bankruptcy, because if they cut a deal outside of bankruptcy, I think they expose themselves to all sorts of there's all sorts of legal exposure from their members.
So talk about the horns of a horrible dilemma for those for the leaders of the public sector unions.
Oh, I think it's very difficult. And as I said to somebody this morning, I don't care where you are in the philosophical spectrum, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, union, non-union, you can't look at this situation and not feel some measure of sympathy and empathy for the people who are going to be victimized here in this process. And also not to feel, at least from my perspective, a lot of anger and disgust at the leadership and the political leaders who made a lot of decisions that got us to this pass.
Promises and decisions.
One of the great legacies of Kwame Kilpatrick, above and beyond all the corruption that has landed him in federal prison, are some of the financial deals that set the city on this final downward spiral. Mm. I think when people dig more deeply into this, that will become abundantly clear.
You know, Daniel, we say when we talk about this week after week, talking about this possible bankruptcy, that these are uncharted waters. Mm-hmm. So what does this all mean for public sector employees throughout Michigan? What could it mean to be a vested pensioner of a city anywhere in Michigan that's in financial distress?
Well, I think one thing it probably means is you better pay a lot more attention to the fact of how the political leadership in your community is behaving and operating, how they're running the affairs of state or city, because it matters. It really matters if they're living within their means, if the community is competitive, if its tax rates are competitive. I mean, Detroit's in a position right now where it's so woefully uncompetitive. It's the highest tax rate in the state. One of the arguments that Kevin Orr will make as part of this whole thing is to say that we can't raise taxes anymore. We're at the statutory limit or just under the statutory limit, and the only way you can raise that limit is by an act of the legislature, and that's just not going to happen. Hmm. Plus the fact is that it just makes Detroit even more uncompetitive. One of the things that has underpinned the municipal finance market and bond market for forever has been the understanding that localities and school districts can raise taxes to meet the obligations of their municipal bonds. Well, now you have a situation where we're saying we can't raise taxes anymore as a practical matter or as a political matter, and therefore we can't pay. Hmm. And therefore, we have to cut a deal, and people are going to have to take haircuts, is in the common parlance, which is a kind of a flip way of saying they're just going to have to get by with less. And
as you say, if
really
it's,
difficult.
If it's a bank or it's an institution, oh well. But when you think of a retired water worker, a retired firefighter, a police, and they're not going back to work, they're not going to be able to recoup that. It really does hit hard when you think of the emotions behind it.
Well, that's exactly right. And the other thing, too, is a lot of these financial investors probably, we don't know for sure, but probably have written their investments in Detroit down to as much as zero. So if they do get 10 cents, or if they're offered 10 cents on the dollar, which is the number that's floated out there, and there's a lot of ways to calculate that, and they had $100 million in the city of Detroit and they wrote it down to zero and they get 10%, they get $10 million. That's $10 million they can use to pay their lawyers or walking away money.
Yeah.
In the case of the pension funds, it's a totally different situation. Now, the money that they have already accrued and saved as part of their funding, they keep that. But they would only get another 10% on top of that as part of a deal. So they still would be, if you're funded at 60%, you might get up to 70, but you're not going to get to 100. And then that money, those monies have to then be parceled out to members, and as well as invested properly and overseen. I think another thing that's going to happen as part of this is that I wouldn't be surprised if the pension boards of both pensions in the city of Detroit are replaced by Kevin Orr. Certainly, I think the general retirement fund will see its board replaced. The police and fire is more debatable because their funding levels, I think, are very close to 80%.
Mm-hmm. Tough thing to watch unfold when you think of the concern in kitchens and living rooms around Michigan of these pensioners.
Absolutely, and all this is happening as at a time when people are getting more and more excited about downtown.
Yeah.
And you're seeing more private capital going into downtown. You're seeing the Illiches confirm that they're going to be doing their $650 million complex, which will include a new Red Wings arena. So there's really a tale of kind of two Detroits that we're seeing unfold. It's a cliche, but I think in this case it's very true.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes, our Thursday check-in. Always enjoy it. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Meanwhile, a judge appointed to fix the finances of a troubled Detroit court is moving quickly to save millions of dollars before the new budget year begins. It's being reported layoff notices have been served to 80 employees at the 36th District Court, although the job losses could be spared through other cuts, including a 10% reduction in pay. Michigan Appeals Court Judge Michael Talbot was recently tapped to turn the court around, and he plans to meet with unions next week. Union negotiator Robert Davis says some proposed cuts are too severe. And here at Stateside, we always want to hear your thoughts. Are you keeping an eye on the fiscal crisis in Detroit? What are your thoughts? Is bankruptcy the only option for the city? Let us know. We're on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And of course, we're on MichiganRadio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside. Still to come, it was June 1950 when Northwest Flight 2501 vanished in a terrible storm over Lake Michigan. 63 years later, one explorer has not given up searching for that plane. We'll find out why in 15 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. All across the world, ancient cultures have built impressive stone circles. Think Stonehenge in England, the Drumbeg Stone Circle in West Cork, Ireland, or the Stone Circle on Beaver Island. No one knows exactly their significance, but whether they were used for burials, for community gatherings, or connected to religious or agricultural events, like the summer solstice, people will always wonder why they exist. Today, stone circles are appearing across the U.S. mainly to pay homage to our ancient ancestors, and one of those exists here in Michigan. Poet and educator Terry Wooten built his own stone circle nearly 30 years ago, designed to capture the atmosphere of ancient cultures. It's located north of Traverse City. Terry joins us from close to there, from his home in Elk Rapids. Welcome, Terry.
Well, thank you.
Tell me, what is the significance of your stone circle? Describe it for us.
Well, I built it as sort of a visual enhancer to poetry. It's 88 boulders. They go a ton to 8 ton apiece, and they're in three concentric circles with a fire in the middle, like a bonfire, campfire. And I wanted just to give poets, storytellers, musicians a special place to gather. In some ways, I think poetry has lost its roots, you know, for thousands and thousands of years. It was recited around fires, or histories were passed on that way. And I wanted to try to take it back to that. It's a family event here. Sometimes we don't get family. Sometimes we get a lot of college kids. Sometimes we get a lot of elders. And sometimes you'll get a mix of all those cultures.
And what do you do there? What are the events that you do there, Terry?
Pretty much it's all poetry or song, storytelling. It starts around 9 o'clock on Saturday nights. I usually start it. Anybody's welcome to speak here. Poems have to be done by memory. We don't allow too much reading here. If it's a child who comes, maybe a young lady or a young guy, and they didn't know that, it would break the rules for them.
What is it, Terry, that happens as people are sitting around encircled by a stone circle as compared to sitting out in the yard around the fire?
Well, I think, again, if you'd see the stone circle, it's pretty impressive, you know. Boulders that go a ton to 8 ton apiece, and then the circles. Nobody really knows why stone circles were built. It adds that mystery quality to it, kind of a special, natural, magical sort of ambiance. And where it's situated, where I build it, it's crested by trees to a lot of evergreens and pines, and so it's got a wonderful acoustic quality to it. you can bounce the words off the leaves or the trees, you know, and it comes back. So acoustically, it's very sound, too. And again, just the ambiance kind of reminds people how to act in the presence of poetry or song.
Now, you grow up in Cadillac. I'm interested, as you were growing up, when did you become interested in poetry?
I was born in Cadillac, but I was raised in a little town of about 800 people south of Cadillac, southeast of Cadillac, called Marion. And I guess I always had a very inquisitive, questioning nature. My mother said I asked more questions than my sisters, but, you know, times 100. I was constantly following her around. But I didn't recite my poems by memory back then because I was a football player and I didn't think football players were supposed to write poetry, so I kind of kept that side of me hidden. And it just kind of grew from there.
I know you have hundreds of poems memorized, and hundreds of them are your own. Would you give us one of your poems? I'd really love to hear old Ernie Harwell.
Oh, you would.
I would.
Actually, I have 559 poems committed to memory.
That's phenomenal.
And the old Ernie Harwell is a favorite in Michigan, and I have two thank you letters from Ernie Harwell for that poem. And it goes like this. Over 5,000 Detroit Tiger ball games ago, Grandpa took me trout fishing in the old Butterfield Creek. On the way home, half asleep, I listened to Ernie Harwell recite the late innings of a Tiger ball game while Grandpa's cigarette glowed like a campfire in the dark. Outside the car windows, Michigan flowed along. I felt content as young trout snuggled under a log in the current. Since that night, only thing on the radio that rivaled rock and roll or country and western music is Ernie Harwell going on and on like an epic poem full of Ty Cobb trivia and Detroit Tiger history. Like a human baseball encyclopedia always sounding the same, but always different through three decades of most of the incarnations of my life. I even proposed to my wife with Ernie crooning in the background. Or was it the Rolling Stones song, Time Waits for No One? That was over 2,000 Tiger games ago. Grandpa's been gone since 1979. Late that last September, he whispered, "Psst, I've got a secret. I'm dying." Then he sat there like an old house beside the road and watched life go by like a Denny McClain fastball. There isn't any real security, but Ernie Harwell and Airwaves came close. For my Grandpa Humboldt and Ernie Harwell.
Beautiful. That was beautiful. To poet and educator Terry Wooten and his poem, Old Ernie Harwell. That was wonderful. So we'll hear more like that at your events. And I know you're marking the 30th anniversary of the Stone Circle with some evenings of celebration, August 10th and 17th. But as Terry was saying to us, regular gatherings at the Stone Circle start June 22nd, and they continue every Saturday through Labor Day weekend. And we have put a link to Terry's site on our website at michiganradio.org. Terry Wooten, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
It was 63 years ago this month when Northwest Flight 2501 took off from LaGuardia Airport in New York on a nonstop flight to Minneapolis. Flight 2501 never made it to its destination. The DC-4 prop liner vanished in a storm over Lake Michigan, somewhere off the coast of South Haven. The 55 passengers and crew of three lost. That crash has become one of the great mysteries of the Great Lakes. Shipwreck explorer and author Valerie Van Heest has joined forces with popular author Clive Cussler. They're trying to figure out what happened to Flight 2501. Her new book, Fatal Crossing, explores the search for Flight 2501. Valerie Van Heest joins us now from Holland. Hi, Valerie.
Hello, Cindy.
So take us back, Valerie, to June 23rd, 1950, Northwest Flight 2501, doing a very routine flight to Minneapolis, right?
Yes, a routine flight. We had been flying cross-country for a couple of years at that point, and tickets were quite pricey back then, about $100 each way to fly cross-country, close to $1,000 in today's money. But there were 55 people on board doing just that 63 years ago.
And was there any reason to feel that there was some alarming event on the flight?
Well, there was a brewing storm in the Midwest. And the captain, Robert Lind, a 34-year-old pilot, he was given notice by the company that he would be encountering some weather. Now, this was nothing that he hadn't experienced dozens of times before. He'd been flying that route over Lake Michigan to Minneapolis and on to Seattle for many years. But obviously, this storm stopped him. There seems no doubt this many years later that the accident was storm-related.
Mm.
But the mystery is we don't know where it occurred.
So there was radio communication.
There was radio communication along the way, about 20 radio calls, in fact, between New York and Battle Creek, Michigan. But after that, it got very spotty. There was one last call at 12:13 a.m., which would have been June 24th, and it was the pilot asking for clearance to go down. He didn't say why, but we can only suspect this many years later that he was trying to fly under the weather. Going
yes.
over it wasn't an option back then. Planes couldn't fly that high. They were unpressurized. But with that last communication came a denial from air traffic control, and that was the last anyone heard of Flight 2501.
And when did it become apparent? Was it only when the flight did not land, or how long before they realized something awful had happened?
The indication came about 20 minutes later when the flight didn't make its checkpoint in Milwaukee.
Mm.
The captains were required to call in when they were over every major city along their route. And as soon as he didn't check in, the radio operator became suspicious and an alert was put out. But it was until 5:30 the next morning when they knew that the plane would have run out of fuel that Northwest Airlines was certain they'd lost a plane.
Wow. Now, what kind of search happened in the days after?
Well, actually, what happened was the biggest search that's ever occurred on the Great Lakes. The next day, Sunday the 25th, there were four major cruisers going back and forth across Lake Michigan. These were Navy and Coast Guard vessels. There were hundreds of small boats. There were dozens of airplanes conducting a search, but they found no traces of the plane. It took them 2 days to find small bits of debris, including clothing and luggage and some seat cushions, and tragically, pieces of human flesh floating on the surface of Lake Michigan.
So they definitely found parts of bodies, but no intact bodies?
No intact bodies. And when we think about an accident, like most recently, the crash of Air France in the Atlantic Ocean,
yes,
falling from 40,000 feet to the ocean surface, they still found intact bodies. In this case, they didn't find anything with any bone in it, just flesh. It was a horrible tragedy, indicating that the plane hit the water with a furious force, just tearing the plane to shreds and all the people inside.
So it was a big story and a big search in 1950.
Imagine our headlines in Detroit, in Kalamazoo, in the little town of South Haven. 58 people perish in the country's worst aviation disaster right here in Lake Michigan. We've never seen anything like that before.
So I'm very interested, Valerie Van Heest. Here we are in 2013. You have been searching for Flight 2501 since 2004. How did you get hooked into this, and why are you searching? Yeah.
Well, I'm part of an organization. I'm a founding member of a nonprofit, Michigan Shipwreck Research Association, and we've made it our business to search for lost shipwrecks in Lake Michigan. In 2003, it came to our attention that this accident had occurred. It had never been found, and we wondered if we might run into it while looking for shipwrecks.
Hmm.
Well, apparently we weren't the only ones that were starting to pay attention to this accident. Renowned author Clive Cussler was at his home in Arizona thinking just the same thing. He picked up the phone, he called us, and within a few days we had a partnership. And we began searching the lake together, looking for the remains of this plane.
So is it the idea that these 58 people just vanished. There was nothing to bury, no closure. What emotionally has hooked you and Clive Cussler?
What initially I think hooked both of us is the mystery of this, the fact that the country's worst disaster, followed by the Great Lakes' largest search effort, netted nothing, no results. And it was the mystery. He and I and people we're associated with are all interested in solving mysteries. And so we tackled this, but something changed for me about 2 years into the project. In trying to research the airplane and where it might have gone down, I came across the first person who was a descendant, a relative of one of the victims. That led to another. That led to another. And in time, I've contacted nearly all of the families of the 58 victims. And for me, it changed. It was not so much about finding the plane. It was finding the stories of these people, their lives, what happened to them, how their lives were cut short. And this has been a journey, a much different journey for me now.
How has it changed you?
Well, it's changed me in a number of ways. It's reminded me that our loved ones, while they might be gone, can always be remembered in our minds. I've lost a number of people in my life, and this tells me that they can always remain with us. That was one big lesson. Another lesson is the idea that we're not, my search for one thing really led in a totally different direction. It opened my eyes to what's more important here. What's more important is the stories of these people and what happened, as opposed to finding the wreck.
So, in a sense, the family members that you have met could get some closure.
You know, I think they will. And it had been my hope for a number of years to write a book about this once we had discovered the wreck. But I realized that we didn't need to discover the wreck to really discover what happened. And I think after 10 years of studying this now, talking to family members, talking to a number of seniors who were with Northwest Airlines or with the Coast Guard, I think now I've been able to piece this accident together and provide a reason for the crash that the government and the FAA and the NTSB of old was not able to provide.
And in essence, what do you feel happened that night?
Well, without generating a spoiler that would disappoint people looking forward to reading the book, what I can say is, like so many accidents, whether they're in the air or on water or on our highways, there were a series of mistakes and poor decisions along the way. And what eventually caused this plane to crash, I believe, was the last in a series of six things that happened that night.
So a cascade of events.
A chain of bad events. And ultimately, the storm was so bad that night that a number of other planes flying chose to turn around and wait out the storm. Our pilot, Robert Lind, chose to go ahead. And ultimately, that was the worst decision he could make.
When I think of the times that I've had some interesting choppy flights over Lake Michigan, and they were in the day. Do you let your mind go there of what that must have been like after midnight, pitch black in a storm over Lake Michigan?
Terribly frightening. I, of course, in researching this, anytime I fly and feel the least bit of turbulence, I get a bit edgy. But I can imagine these people in an unpressurized plane on a dark and stormy night being bumped around. It must have been terribly frightening. The only thing that makes me, and I hope the families, feel a little bit better about this is we know whatever happened quickly. There was no suffering. It was immediate. And that's been part of what I've tried to do in writing my book, Fatal Crossing, about this accident, is to bring a measure of comfort to the families.
Shipwreck explorer and author Valerie Van Heest, searching for Northwest Flight 2501, which crashed into Lake Michigan on June 23rd, 1950, in the book Fatal Crossing, will tell her feelings of what she thinks happened on that fateful, fateful night. Thank you so much for talking with us, Valerie.
Thank you, Cindy.
Still to come, 50 years ago this August, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech. But King delivered an earlier version of that speech, and he did it in Detroit. We'll get the story in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's a new traffic jam each morning that I've noticed at the end of my street. It began the week after school let out. It starts about 8:30 every morning. The stream of minivans and SUVs waiting to turn into the parking lot of the church at the end of my street to drop the kids off for summer day camp. It's a scene being repeated all over Michigan, kids being hauled to one organized activity or another, from computer camp to theater camp to dance camp to summer swim club meets, and you get the idea. And Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon has a question. Whatever happened to good old-fashioned playing in the summer? And with summer starting tomorrow, John, I thought we should explore this with you a little bit. Now, do you mean, hey, whatever happened to the days when you blasted out the door after breakfast, you maybe came home from a sandwich at lunch, and then you were gone until mom called you in for dinner?
Yes, exactly. In fact, our rule was probably your rule. When the lights come on, you have to come home. And that was your mom, quote unquote, no more, no less. My parents had no idea, I don't think, for the most part, where we were. They might have a general sense that you're with the Bogards or the Smiths or whatever.
Yeah.
But otherwise, we're up to ourselves, and when you make your own games, it makes you more creative. It also makes you, I think, more mature in terms of you've got to settle your own disputes. If it's a do-over in baseball, you do a do-over. If you cannot resolve the argument, the game's over. So without any parents involved, without any umpires or officials, you have to resolve your own arguments. And we played three-man baseball back then. I mean, we played all kinds of crazy games, home run derby, you name it. And all my friends who did this, who now have kids growing up, they do regret the fact that they did not have the same kind of fun, their kids, that they had. And it's hard to get that back.
And it's interesting. When I think about what's behind all of the organized, scheduled sports and activities, don't you think there's been a real major boost in the parental worry factor? And let's say, comparing the way we grew up, I grew up in the 60s. And you think about in Southeast Michigan, you had the Oakland County child killings in 76, 77. You had the huge national story with the murder of Adam Walsh in Florida. That was in 1981. And then since then, there's been pretty much, it seems to be, a nonstop stream of similar crimes. Have those left today's parents unable to let their children be unsupervised?
I'm sure they have, and you cannot blame them, obviously. Mm-hmm. That's not the point here, of course. And the difference in the 60s and 70s versus now is, I'm sure that, you know, bad things have happened to kids throughout history, undoubtedly, but we did not know much about those things. Mm-hmm. And now the Amber Alerts and so on, you know within 2 minutes on cable TV what's going on and where it's going on. And therefore, we're probably all more attuned to it, perhaps rightly so, but it has to make you paranoid. And therefore, structured sports, being on that van, going to soccer camp, looks pretty appealing.
And so kids are losing out in what ways?
I think, like I said, the spontaneity they lose, the creativity, the ability to resolve their own disputes, and also just the freedom to enjoy your summer. Man, there's a reason why we're so thrilled when school got out, because all of a sudden we had no supervision for about 2.5 months. Now when school gets out, you're on a van just going to somewhere else. And that can't be, a lot of kids I know simply don't like these things that much, but they have to go. Now, I think one of the things that's changed is in my neighborhood growing up, in your neighborhood growing up, man, anyone on that street was allowed to grab me at any time and scold me as needed.
Keep now, you in line.
Exactly. Now you wouldn't even know your neighbors. So I think my parents would have felt much more comfortable with me around the neighborhood, knowing that the whole neighborhood knows who we are and is looking out for us and know, you know, where trouble is afoot.
Watching out for that bacon boy.
Exactly. Those bacon boys.
What do you say to today's parents then who say, well, fine, I don't know who's living three doors down. I just don't, because that's the way neighborhoods are.
This is a problem without an easy solution, because if you want your kid to play on the garage hoop and so on like the old days, mm-hmm. drive through any neighborhood, and you'll see a lot of hoops and nobody playing on them. In the old days, every hoop had three or four kids, you know, playing their mm-hmm. games and whatnot. Okay, let's say you want to pull your kid out of soccer camp. All right, play with whom? Everyone else is at soccer camp. You need a critical mass of kids in your neighborhood to make this work, and right now that's just not going to happen. So I don't know really what you can do to solve this problem other than to have some, you know, some time in the backyard with the neighborhood kids to themselves.
I suspect that some of this is apart from the security concerns, because I mean I remember when the Oakland County child killings
sure.
were happening. That you know we're feeling that today. There's probably also a degree of the modern parent who is pushing their kid to build that resume. So activities that'll help you win that swim meet or that dance competition or look good on a college app.
It's a brutal world, man. And my essay at Michigan out of high school, I put an X through it. I was not going to fill out the essay. I had a 3.5 from high school. That would not – they'd send me an X back today.
They would. Saying,
you're not going anywhere. And it was just easier, I think. I don't know if I would get in today at all. And it's much more competitive, and not just academically, as you say, mm-hmm. the extracurriculars, the sports, the vice president of your class, whatever it takes. So there's a sense that you need to specialize in sports or the oboe or a theater. You need to drop everything else for swimming. You need to drop everything else for soccer. And I would like to say this strongly as a former high school hockey coach and baseball coach. Mm-hmm. That stuff is crazy. There are two players I coached at Culver Academies who made it to the NHL for 7 or 8 years. These are serious players who played on Olympic teams and so on. They were both captain of the golf team. They did not touch a hockey stick or ice for 3 or 4 months. They were fine. The burnout factor is grossly underestimated, as well as the damage to joints and so on. You talk to orthopedic doctors. The 20-year-old women they're seeing who played soccer their whole lives have got 40-year-old knees. It is we're wearing out the same joints doing the same thing every day for 2 hours. That part is crazy. That can be stopped.
And mentally as well.
It's a chore.
Needing to rediscover the love of whatever it is.
Exactly. I used to be the high school hockey coach here in Ann Arbor of mm-hmm. the Huron River Rats. Chew on that one for a second.
I love that name.
Yeah, exactly. We're very proud of the River Rats, actually. But I told my players, I said, you know, yeah, we have a summer team. If you're not here, it's not a problem. Go play golf. Go play lacrosse. Play something else. And my players came back hungrier for hockey than everyone else's players. And, man, in January and February, the burnout factor, again, even on a team basis, is grossly underestimated. If my guys were still looking forward to coming to the rink in February and your guys weren't, if we're within 2 goals, we're going to beat you. Because
yeah.
my guys don't want the season to end. Everyone else did.
Food for thought. In our last minute, give us your favorite summer memory, game or some kind of memory.
Man, the games you don't see anymore, capture the flag, kick the can, all run by kids. I became a catcher in baseball because as the smallest kid in my neighborhood out of 20, it's the only way I could play in the game is to play catcher. And I still know all those kids' names. I still see them around occasionally, and we all tell the same stories. Who tells any stories about soccer camp?
I have to ask you about the bologna game.
Doggone it.
I didn't get out
very
without
quickly,
the bologna game.
Bologna game, we were allowed to come home for lunch during school. Our parents may or may not have been there. So we took slabs of Oscar Mayer bologna, whipped them up to the ceiling. If you do it right, Cindy, it sticks on that new latex paint perfectly. And that's the first part of the lunch meat biathlon. The second part is when it falls to earth, you've got to take at least one bite out of it or else your score doesn't count. These are rules that we came up with. And therefore, you have three little boys around the one little boy whose bologna is left screaming in his ears, trying to get the bologna to fall on his face so he can take a bite and say, aha, I win.
The bologna game.
There are no bologna game camps.
You can just have fun with it. Have a great summer, John.
Cindy, you too.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Everybody's got a story. Some are very extraordinary stories. It might be good for somebody to look into theirs.
Because a story is the shortest distance between two people.
The Living Room is our ongoing storytelling series. Today's show, Beyond the Dream, 50 years later. August 28th marks the 50th anniversary of what might be the most celebrated political gathering in our nation's history. Close to 250,000 people poured onto the Washington Mall to show their solidarity with the growing civil rights movement. It was the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. The march might be best known as the venue where Martin Luther King Jr. gave his now iconic I Have a Dream speech. But he didn't debut the speech in Washington, D.C.
As I move toward my conclusion, you're asking, I'm sure, what can we do here in Detroit to help in the struggle in the South?
King gave an earlier version of his now famous speech in Detroit on June 23rd of 1963. Some Detroiters contend that the events of that weekend are just as relevant, if not more so, than the March on Washington. The Detroit Walk to Freedom was organized by the Detroit Council for Human Rights. It was conceived as a way to commemorate the race riot that took place in the city 20 years earlier. But it was also an event to protest the current state of race and economic relations, both in the urban North and the American South. Living Room producer Zach Rosen spoke with a handful of Detroiters who were at that gathering in June of 63.
I remember it was a beautiful day, and I remember there was this joy everywhere.
It was just all in all a fantastically beautiful day.
And as a 16-year-old, how would you have found out about the protest? Are there posters at record store?
No, no. My friend Mike Evans and I, two of the young ladies we were dating, they knew about it, so we went with them.
I bet you're wondering how I knew.
History is a story. It comes from the word histoire. And as D.H. Carr said, it's a dialogue between the past and the present. Well, I'm Grace Boggs, and I'm an awfully old woman, and I was born nearly 100 years ago. So in 1963, I was 48 years old.
The whole center city of Detroit was being cleared of blacks to make way for urban renewal. The freeway construction had begun, so there was a lot of unrest. I'm Reverend Dr. Nicholas Hood, Sr. I was 40 then.
I'm Ron Scott. I was 16 in 1963. I had had a gun pulled on me and put a shotgun in my face when I was 13 years old as part of the mayor of the city of Detroit's crackdown on crime, which was really cracking down on a number of African Americans. So it was very significant to me.
We started holding meetings in churches once a week to announce the march. And incredibly, the whole state became involved.
My name is Jennifer Wynn. I was 15 in 1963. And I had a social studies teacher by the name of Miss Norton. She was very strict and she was very conservative. She always wore a dark color and the old nurse's shoes. And she always would talk about John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King. She made an assignment for us to go to the walk. And if you didn't do the assignment, you know, you would fail the class. So, you know, this is in June. It was like, okay, well, you know, I got to go.
Well, I think the struggle for rights had been a struggle for integration. And now we were struggling about what kind of society were we going to have in this country and who was going to lead it.
So I had to walk up to Dexter, take the Dexter bus, and it would take me all the way downtown. That was a 45-minute ride. At that time, you know, you could ride the bus by yourself. You didn't have to worry about anyone trying to kidnap you or say anything bad to you because everyone was very nice at that time. And it was just crowded. I had never seen so many people in all my life. And we just started walking.
I invited our church to join the march with me. And we joined the march at about 1 or 1:30 on that Sunday. They'd already been going. And we walked the 4 or 5 miles of the route, singing all the way. And everybody we saw, even the people on the sides watching, were singing. much to our surprise, when we arrived at Cobo Hall, there were so many people crowding inside the building that the line of marches where I was were turned down behind Cobo Hall. They were all the way to the river.
And were you able to hear what was happening?
No, actually, in all honesty, I didn't get in. They did have speakers, but in those days, the electronics weren't as advanced as they are today.
My good friend, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, and all of the officers and members of the Detroit Council of Human Rights, ladies and gentlemen, I cannot begin to say to you this afternoon how thrilled I am, and I cannot begin to tell you the deep joy that comes to my heart as I participate with you in what I consider the largest and greatest demonstration for freedom ever held in the United States.
To me, it was more significant than the March on Washington because people remember the speeches. There were big shots speaking on August 28th. I mean, it was the organization. It was the involvement of people. It was the connection with the local struggle that was so important.
I have a dream this afternoon that one day right here in Detroit, Negroes will be able to buy a house or rent a house anywhere that their money will carry them, and they will be able to get a job.
It really wasn't just about that, the I Have a Dream. It really was a march. For instance, that year, 1963, there was a woman who was a sex worker who was killed by the name of Cynthia Scott. She was African-American. The cop that killed her was white. And people got very upset about that because she was just kind of wantonly shot down. And they challenged it with that without even raising the question about whether she was a prostitute. She was a human being. Today, in many cases, people want to know, well, was this guy a good guy? Was he a bad guy? The value of human life, I think, has changed to some degree.
We will be able to achieve this new day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing with the Negroes in the spiritual of all, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty.
I just remember the fact that Detroit, in its essence, was a place that could help transform the world. And I think that's similarly the case today.
I have a dream. I have a dream. I have a dream. I still have a dream. I have a dream. I have a dream.
The Living Room is produced by Allison Downey and Zach Rosen. We have information on our website about some commemorative marches taking place in Detroit this weekend. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer was Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Katie Theory, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us.